Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI speaks of the Eucharist as an antidote to the individualism in which the West is immersed. We hear about the Vatican's new news portal, due to be launched by Pope Benedict XVI himself this coming Wednesday. The United Nations World Food Programme steps up its food assistance to the more vulnerable people caught up in the Libyan conflict. And the International Day in Support of Victims of Torture reminds us that torture is a crime and gives us the opportunity to stand united against this cruel violation of human rights. Pope Benedict XVI says the Eucharist is the antidote to the individualism in which the West is immersed and which is spreading throughout the globe. Speaking to the crowds gathered in St. Peter's Square for the recitation of the Midday Angelus on Sunday, the Pope spoke of the Eucharist as of a beating heart that gives life to the whole mystical body of the Church. Lydia O'Kane reports.
In today's individualistic culture, the Eucharist is an antidote which operates in the minds and hearts of believers and continually sows in them the logic of the communion, service, sharing. In other words, the logic of the Gospel. Those were Pope Benedict XVI's words speaking to the faithful in St. Peter's Square at this Sunday's Angelus. He was referring to the Feast of Corpus Christi, which is celebrated in many countries this Sunday.
In many places today, the Church celebrates the solemnity of the body and blood of Christ. May our hearts rejoice in the great gift of Jesus, the bread of life, who has given himself for us and has come to nourish us. As we open our hearts to others and walk the path of life, may he always sustain and guide us.
Without the Eucharist, Pope Benedict said, the Church does not exist because it constitutes the Church's most precious treasure. It is, he added, like the beating heart that gives life to the whole mystical body of the Church, a social organism based on the spiritual but real tie to Christ. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Thanks there to Lydia O'Kane for that report. And Pope Benedict, on Wednesday, will be launching a new Vatican portal, offering an exclusive multimedia presentation of all the other communications websites of the Holy See. The portal, to be found at www.newsva, includes the best of our own Vatican radio site, but also the latest news from the newspaper, L'Osservatore Romano, from the Pontifical Council for Social Communications, from VIS, the Vatican's Information Service, and from the MISNA Missionary News Agency. The new portal was launched on Monday at a press conference with the President of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications, Archbishop Claudio Celli. Philippa Hitchin spoke to him to find out all the details.
I think that the new portal is responding to the need of having something that can give a better approach to the Vatican news. As you know, we have different and important sources: Osservatore Romano, Vatican Radio, Fides News Agency, or the VIS, Vatican Information Service. But you have to look around, and you have to get in touch with all of them. Now the new portal is presenting the most important pieces of news of every source. And the importance is here that it's a multimedia portal. It means that you have the printed news. You can listen at the programs of the Vatican Radio. And you can also listen at the two radio giornali, in Italian and English. And also you have the film. It means that, as you know, we are present in YouTube. So you have a direct access to YouTube. And also you can follow some special ceremonies of the Holy Father live, through the streaming. And so all together in the new portal is giving you the possibility to have a direct, immediate approach to the most important pieces of news of the Holy See.
Who do you see as your target audience? Is it for journalists or is it for interested Catholics, for anybody?
It is really for everybody. you will perceive that we are using the best technologies at the moment. It means that you can follow the portal also through Facebook and also with your iPad if you have, or iPhone. But at the same time, you have also the Twitter, the titles of the main news. It's important because the portal is divided in three main sectors. It means that you have the latest news, five or six latest news. Afterwards, you have the Vatican news. It means from the Holy Father himself, so his speeches. From the Roman Curia, it means if a congregation is presenting a document or making an intervention, you can find it there. The third sector is the appointments. But afterwards, you have news from the world. And also, it's quite important, you have the church in the world. Because it is, we were discovering that some instruments of communication are not mentioning what the church is doing in many countries. And, for example, you have some episcopal conference that can make an intervention or a document. Now you have the possibility to read immediately the document. And so you have a general perspective. Certainly, we are not a press agency. But what we want to do is to give to everybody the possibility of a direct, immediate access to the news from the Vatican, and mainly from the Magisterium of the Pope.
The United Nations World Food Programme, WFP, has started moving food assistance through a new humanitarian corridor into western Libya to get help to areas beyond reach until now because of the fighting. Meanwhile, in other parts of the country, food continues to arrive through land and sea channels. WFP is also feeding thousands who have fled into neighbouring Tunisia and Egypt. I spoke to Emilia Casella, WFP spokesperson in Geneva, who explained that the UN agency began moving food supplies into Libya by road and sea soon after the conflict erupted.
The programs have been going on since basically the beginning of the Libya crisis, as people began to flood across the borders into Egypt and Tunisia. And it's been going on since then and has continued, and we're projecting that it will be going on at least until the end of August, if not longer, but at the moment we've extended it to the end of August. We've so far fed 500,000 people in Libya, as well as many people who have gone across the borders into Tunisia and Egypt. It's quite a large program helping people both inside and outside of the country.
You say they're the people who are most vulnerable. Who are they?
Well, in fact, inside Libya, almost the entire population now is vulnerable. There's an active conflict going on, and we're very concerned about access to food inside Libya. Many people may not know that the population of 6.5 million relies heavily on imports of food. Up to 75% of the food that is consumed in Libya is imported. And that means with an active conflict going on, all of the supply lines for regular commercial trade have been disrupted. Also, fuel prices are very high. Fuel is hard to get, so it's difficult for people to transport food into the regular market. So this has made large portions of the community vulnerable. We are very much obviously trying to reach those who are the most vulnerable, families with young children, the elderly, hospitals, and other public structures that we can help to reach the people who need it, need the help the most.
Have refugee camps been set up inside Libya at all? I mean, where are the people fleeing to?
Well, inside Libya, we're working together with the Libyan Red Crescent to distribute food. And so the Red Crescent is using those channels to distribute food directly to families, as well as through hospital structures, schools, and the like. Inside of Libya, I don't know that there are large encampments of people who have fled areas per se. The larger encampments that we've been providing food for have been for those migrant workers and other workers who have, and Libyans who have left Libya, either across the Egyptian border or the Tunisian border. And in addition, many of those workers were supporting their families back home. And so we're also helping them because they have no longer any income in order to support their families. So the encampments are more on the borders than inside.
Now, you were saying earlier that your operation will be in operation, if I can say that, until at least the end of August. What's going to happen after that?
Well, I think this is a rolling emergency that the entire humanitarian community is keeping a very close eye on and is continuing to assess as goes along. So as we have extended our emergency operation into the end of August, the cost of that operation is $100 million. But as the situation progresses, obviously it will continue to be assessed and if need be continued. This isn't just something that the World Food Program is doing, but obviously all humanitarian organizations involved in the assistance to the population of Libya are involved in the process of providing that humanitarian relief for as long as it's needed. It's our job to be there to help the people for as long as they need us, and we're going to hopefully try to do that.
The emergency operation, I read on your press release, has received only a quarter of the funds it needs. Where do those funds come from?
Generally, we receive funds from government donors, so we receive funds from European governments. We receive funds from all over the world. Generally, that's the source of our funding.
Emilia, you yourself were saying that it's a concerted effort, but I understand that the WFP is actually the lead agency for the provision of logistics and telecommunications services to the entire humanitarian community there. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. We do this in most every emergency. The humanitarian community operates on a system of clusters in which different agencies help to coordinate the work in different segments of humanitarian assistance. So the World Food Program has an expertise in logistics and in telecommunications, and when an emergency occurs, our teams go in to coordinate the movement of supplies and also to set up the telecoms and also the information technology, the computer systems that help run the entire operation.
Are you satisfied with the way your emergency operation is being conducted?
It's never easy to run an emergency operation in a situation where there's an active conflict going on. And so we'll be satisfied when we can reach all the people who need help and when the emergency is over and when we can go out and continue on perhaps and help people in other locations, other places. But so in as much as we've reached 500,000 people inside of Libya and we've managed to open up supply lines into the east of the country and into the west of the country, that we're moving food in a regular basis, also through the port of Misrata, where we are pleased that we've been able to reach the people. But it's a very difficult job, which is in a very volatile situation. Sometimes we can't reach the people we need to due to insecurity. So you can never be 100% satisfied, basically, until the problem is resolved.
Yes, it must be dangerous for you people as well.
Well, it certainly is a situation where humanitarian workers are very, very dedicated. Our staff has been working around the clock, and we're talking about everybody from nutritionists to truck drivers to logistics and planning staff. These are people who are very dedicated. Those who are on the ground, indeed, in many cases are in situations that are quite volatile and quite difficult, and definitely my hat goes off to them for the work they do. I'm impressed with the people I work with, I must say.
What feelings, what impressions do you get from them who are on the ground? What do they say about the conflict?
Well, they're also very touched by the dedication of people on the ground. You know, we don't all come in just as foreigners into any emergency. The vast majority of humanitarian workers come from the countries that they work in. And so we're working alongside many, many Libyans, both in the East and the West, who are dedicated to one thing, and that's to helping vulnerable people who need food, who need water, who need medicine. We work together with the Libyan Red Crescent, and they are a neutral body that has a mandate, just as we do, to help people in need. And they are around the clock working in conditions that can be often quite perilous. And they are an extremely dedicated group of people. Everyone wants that the conflict would ultimately be resolved so that people can have all of the services that they need and go back to a normal life.
I'm going to ask you a silly question, Emilia. When we talk about food assistance, what kind of food do you actually get over there?
Well, the normal monthly ration is a dry ration that we give out. It's not cooked food. We are giving usually a ration that consists of a certain amount of pulses that would be lentils or other beans. There will be some sort of cereal-based product involved, be it wheat flour in this case. We also include a cooking oil in the ration. Often there are also high nutrition products. We've given out date bars in this case that are fortified with extra nutrients. nutrients, and these are ready-to-eat foods that can be given very easily to children and don't need to be cooked. So those are the basics that go into a ration. Very much wheat flour, date bars, lentils and beans are a big staple of the ration.
I imagine that according to the different country and different culture you go into, your ration changes a little bit to meet maybe the tastes of the people there.
That's true. In some parts of the world, rather than wheat flour, we give rice. In many parts of the world, we give maize. In some parts of other areas of Africa, we are giving out sorghum or millet. We try very much to correspond to what the local needs are. Also, you know, we purchase a great amount of the food that we are giving out on local markets. And we do that to help to stimulate the local agricultural production, as well as to provide food that is more acceptable to the population and also is less expensive because it doesn't involve transporting it long distances.
The United Nations International Day in Support of Victims of Torture was observed on Sunday. Yes, each year, June the 26th has been designated as a day of observance throughout the globe, reminding us that torture is a crime. It also gives us an opportunity to stand united against this cruel violation of human rights. I spoke to Britta Sidhoff, Secretary General of the International Rehabilitation Council for Torture Victims, about the purpose of this day and about the organization she heads.
The organization is a global one, an international one. We have almost 150 rehabilitation or treatment centers around the whole world on all continents, treating more than about 100,000 persons each year.
The United Nations International Day in Support of Victims of Torture is observed each year on the 26th of June. What is the purpose of this annual observance?
The purpose of the day is really to commemorate, together with torture survivors, torture victims all around the world and with our colleagues who are working against torture and to rehabilitate these people, to stand in solidarity with them and to really honor them and to give them an opportunity that with dignity they may address communities or churches or, you know, do different things to show that you can actually survive torture and you can function as a healthy human being, even though you have been subjected to this horrendous crime. So it's a big day of solidarity, and I would say of showing compassion for these people around the globe.
Now, the theme of this year's International Day is poverty, I see. Why is that?
We've chosen poverty as a theme this year because most of the torture survivors around the world, most people who are actually tortured, are poor people. I don't think we think about this very often when we are looking at it from the Western world, but this is the truth. It's often the person who just comes in the way of a policeman or people that are in communities where there is a high rate of corruption, or you are taken into, let's say, a detention center or a jail for a petty crime, and torture is, unfortunately, in more than 100 countries in the world today, still quite systematically used as a form of repression and to punish people.
You were speaking of say, the Western world, and in our Western world, maybe very superficially, we often think of the word torture as being a bit of an old-fashioned word, something that doesn't happen anymore. In actual fact, that's not true. There are many people across the world who are victims, aren't there?
Absolutely so. And I wish it were something that we should have left behind, you know, in the Middle Ages. But unfortunately, torture continues and torture also changes its ugly face into different shapes. So maybe today there is more torture that is addressing people, maybe not so much, at least in many countries, in a physical way, but that you torture people in a psychological way by repressing them, harassing them, you know, in different ways, making people feel insecure, afraid. So torture is actually a weapon of power still very much used in our world today, sadly to say.
We've just observed the World Refugee Day, and reading up on it, I discovered that 35% of refugees are torture victims.
Yes, it's a staggering figure. We say up to 35%. Of course, it varies very, very much. But as you well know, most of the conflicts of the world today are internal conflicts, and many people are forcibly displaced. So among the internally displaced people and among the people who actually can manage to cross a border and seek asylum, far too large percentage are victims of torture. And of course, this is very much a concern of ours, that many of these people are also detained. And of course, a person who has the remnants, the sequelae of torture, should of course not be detained to put into a prison-like situation where they suffer even more. But it shows you that people who seek protection often are fleeing from situations where they've actually been harassed and tortured or maltreated by different officials, armies, police, or whatever. You know, the long arm against these people is showing in very, very, very many different countries.
I've been looking at your website, the website of the International Rehabilitation Council for Torture Victims, and I was interested to read that torture actually goes beyond the actual torture on the victim itself. It reaches out to the rest of the family and to the community as well.
That's absolutely right. And I think this is again why the 26th of June this year, we are looking very much at poverty, both as a cause and an effect of torture. People are tortured because they are poor, and people who are tortured also remain poor because they are often damaged to such an extent that maybe they cannot work anymore. And in certain countries, I think I don't really have to name communities where whole communities, whole countries actually suffer from a huge repression where torture is used as a systematic tool to keep people down and to make communities very worried that they should not be able to raise their voices, use freedom of speech or association, and where people all the time on purpose are kept in a very uncomfortable and destabilized situation.
You say you don't want to mention countries. I'd like to say Zimbabwe immediately comes to my mind. Would you like to mention a few other ones as well?
No, I think, okay. I mean, Zimbabwe is a very, very good example, of course, where the whole systematic torture by ZANU-PF has been used against people, and some people have managed to flee to South Africa and get some kind of protection, whereas many communities in Zimbabwe are suffering greatly because of the whole threat towards them, and that many people simply don't dare to speak up, don't even dare, some of them, to go and seek some kind of health care for the terrible and often physical torture that they've experienced from these groups. You know, people are using machetes, and it's indescribable the kind of effects this has had on people. So yes, Zimbabwe is absolutely a country where you can say that torture is systematically used to keep people quiet and to try to shut up people. Luckily, we have some people who are brave and working in that country, trying also to address many torture survivors, both inside Zimbabwe and also in South Africa.
In your experiences working with the IRCT, I'm sure you come in contact with many stories. Do torture victims actually recover?
Yes, this is one of the important things, is that you can help people to recover. I think one just needs to mention a few people that are even presidents of countries that have recovered. If you think of the president of Brazil, you think of a Nelson Mandela, and you think of many important writers and artists and so on. Many of them have gone through severe torture and can recover. Of course, I think our work very much aims at having people being able to function more or less normally, and we try to support both the torture survivor and their families and communities. Many times, the effects of torture linger with people in their minds or on their bodies for the rest of their lives, but nevertheless, we try to assist people so that they can live on and lead as normal lives as possible, even though they have gone through this horrendous torture or trauma.
I was reading also on your website that your organization has a strategy, or rather a strategy mix. What
yes.
is that mix?
Well, we have a very clear strategy that has been endorsed by all of our centers around the globe. And there are basically three pillars, you can say. The first one is that we are the global organization offering rehabilitation to torture survivors, because most health systems simply don't do this or don't have the capacity or the knowledge to do this. The second one is that we try to assist victims of torture and their families, if need be, to access justice. Because we believe also that justice in itself heals the victim, but it's also very important to fight impunity. And the third one is, of course, that from our experience working with torture survivors around the globe, that we believe that we can actually show that preventing torture is an absolute necessity, and to use the international instruments, you know, the Convention Against Torture and others, to be observant that governments who try to use torture as a means are more in the focus of policymakers and politicians and the United Nations and others, so they don't get away with this crime.
Are you hopeful? In the past years, have you seen more participation, more awareness, anything improving?
I'm always hopeful. We are hopeful. That's why we're working with this. We don't think it's hopeless. You can see a change in many countries, you know, who turn from a torture society to a democratic one. I think we could just mention, maybe, for example, Chile or an Argentina, that I don't believe, I would say maybe occasionally this happens, but it's certainly not systematic in the same way as it was 20 years ago. So things are changing for the better. I think since 9/11, we have seen a fallback, you know, with the whole discourse, especially under the Bush administration, into encouraging armies to and governments to use torture, because they thought that you could have a torture light, that you could extract information from torture, which you cannot. I mean, a person under extreme pressure, which torture is, you know, will say whatever comes to their mind. So I think the discourse after in the last couple of years has been very fruitful, because I think that many are ashamed of what happened, you know, 10 years ago, 8 years ago, and I don't think many people believe today that torture is a means of bringing about peace or the truth or a just society. So I think maybe we are waking up and seeing the effects of Zimbabwe and other places. Libya is one other, Syria I could mention also. I mean, we know this is not the answer. So I think at least we stand on the 26th of June together with the people that have come out on the other side of torture, and we are quite hopeful about the future. That's why we are still working and carrying on, and need the support, of course, of communities, of churches, of people who have something to offer to support our work around the world.
Do you have a personal message that you would like to give us?
Well, I would say that if you can show solidarity, think about the people who are poor and who are often subjected to torture, to try and break that cycle and to speak up against torture and to support those centers that are trying to work to rehabilitate and give health back to those people who have been tortured. That would be a wonderful message to you, and would be thankful if you would follow that.
That's all from the English Feature Programme today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we will be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English Programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.